A short time later, they entered the low, rocky hills Pierce had pointed out. The trail followed a fairly deep cut between two of the hills. Luke's instincts kicked in. The location was perfect for an ambush.
Jim, is there another way around these hills?
Luke, behind us!
Luke twisted in the saddle and looked back the way they had come. Seven or eight riders had appeared, seemingly from nowhere. The horsemen thundered after them. Pierce looked back and saw the pursuers, too.
Damn it!
He slashed at the horses with his whip. They surged ahead in a gallop. And that was the wrong thing to do, Luke realized.
Jim, no!
But it was too late. The stagecoach careened into the cut between the hills at high speed, tossing the passengers around inside. Puffs of powder smoke appeared on the slopes on both sides as hidden riflemen opened fire on the racing coach. Luke's worry about Diedrich having more men had just come true. It was too late to turn back or go around. Luke knew all they could do was fight their way through. He flung the rifle to his shoulder and started raking the near hillside with lead, hoping to distract the bushwhackers at the very least. Hobie twisted back and forth on the seat next to Pierce and fired his rifle at both slopes, squeezing off rounds as fast as he could work the Winchester's lever. Jessica and Langston were putting up a fight, too. Pierce had his hands full just keeping the team under control. Puffs of dust kicked up from the trail as bullets struck around the flashing hooves of the team. If one of the horses went down, the others probably would too, and then the coach would pile up. When Luke saw the way the gunmen were shooting at the team, he knew they didn't really care about saving Dietrich's life anymore. They just wanted to stop the coach from getting to Moss City. Dietrich was thrown back and forth on top of the stage. He twisted to his side and grabbed the brass rail around the edge of the roof to keep from being thrown off. From the corner of his eye, Luke saw Diedrich raise his legs and lash out with them. He slammed his feet into Hobie's back. The unexpected blow sent Hobie flying forward off the seat and his rifle crashing to the ground. The young man seemed to hang in midair above the team, a split second away from falling under the slashing, steel-shod hooves of the galloping horses. There was nothing Luke could do to save his young partner. It was all up to Hobie's own instincts and quick reactions. With both hands free, Hobie made a desperate grab for the harness of the horses on either side of him. His right hand caught and held, but his legs dropped toward the ground. One foot hit the single tree. He scrambled for purchase on it and lunged, wrapping his left hand around the same harness. Holding on with two hands, he managed to get his other foot on the single tree. His position was still perilous, but better than it had been a few seconds earlier. Up on top of the stagecoach, Diedrich pushed himself to his knees and faced forward. He raised his arms, spread them as much as he could with his wrists tied, and brought them down around Jim Pierce's neck. Diedrich yanked back, choking the Jehu. The attack made Pierce drop the reins. They coiled around loosely on the floorboard, allowing the team to run wild. Luke couldn't risk a shot at Diedrich while the man was locked in such a close struggle with Pierce. He still had the rest of the gunmen to deal with, too. Pierce jammed an elbow into Dietrich's body, but the man's grip didn't loosen. Hobie reached up and grabbed the floorboard. He hooked a foot over it and hauled himself up as the coach careened along the trail. He managed to reach the floorboard and surged up to throw a punch over Pierce's shoulder that caught Diedrich in the face. Dietrich's head rocked back. Hobie caught hold of the businessman's arms and fought to wrench them free from Pierce's throat. Somehow, they were past the bushwhackers. They had run that deadly gauntlet without anyone getting killed. The gunmen on horseback were still coming up quickly from behind, however. Luke twisted in the saddle to throw another shot at them, but his Winchester's hammer just clicked when it fell. Empty. He jammed the rifle back in its scabbard and hauled his mount around. He took the reins in his teeth and filled both hands with the Remington pistols. Using his heels, he sent the horse charging straight at the group of gunmen. It was a damn fool play, and he knew it. But he also knew that doing the unexpected was sometimes a man's most effective weapon, and charging into the face of such odds was certainly unexpected. He bent low and cut loose with the revolvers, trading shots from hand to hand as he guided the horse with his knees. He had another small advantage in that he had plenty of targets to choose from, while his enemies had to concentrate their fire on him. The horse veered back and forth at slight angles in response to Luke's urging. Bullets sang past him, but failed to find the mark. He saw two of the gunmen rock back as his slugs smashed into them, and another man threw up his arms and pitched out of the saddle in a limp sprawl that signified death. That broke the nerve of two of the other gunmen. They whirled their horses to flee, ignoring the shouted curses of their companions. With that, the odds against Luke suddenly dropped to 2-1. He almost felt like he had them outnumbered. The distance between Luke and his enemies had dwindled to almost nothing. He aimed for the gap between their horses and flashed through it, firing to both sides as he did so. They twisted in their saddles and tried to bring their guns to bear on him. The air around Luke's head buzzed like a hornet's nest as bullets fanned past his ears. Still untouched, he leaned back and clamped his teeth down hard on the reins, slowing his horse. He dropped the reins and turned his head in time to see both gunmen topple off their mounts. He didn't know if he had hit them or if each had accidentally shot the other, but it didn't matter. He was still alive.
Luke!
And the stagecoach was still a runaway. Luke holstered the left-hand Remington, grabbed his horse's reins, and wheeled the animal so he could race after the coach. Up ahead, Hobie had succeeded in pulling Dietrich's arms away from Pierce. The Jehu slumped in the seat, gasping for breath. Dietrich clubbed his bound hands together and swung them at Hobie's head. Hobie ducked under the sweeping blow and hooked a punch into Dietrich's ribs. In the frenzy of hate that gripped him, Dietrich didn't even seem to notice the blow. He lunged at Hobie, rammed into him, and knocked the young man off the seat onto the floorboard. Dietrich fell on top of him, landing with his knees in Hobie's stomach. His fingers locked like iron bands around Hobie's throat. From Luke's position, galloping up behind the coach, he couldn't see the two of them anymore. Only Jim Pierce's hunched form as the Jehu tried to draw life-giving air through his bruised throat. Hobie got a flailing hand on Dietrich's face and clawed for the man's eyes. Dietrich flung his head back to get away. He let go of Hobie's throat and dived for the Colt still on the young man's hip. The thong over the hammer had held it in the holster despite Hobie's near fall under the galloping team. Dietrich got his hand on the gun and ripped it free. At the same time, Pierce, barely recovered, made a grab at Dietrich's shoulder. Dietrich twisted and swung the gun at Pierce's head. The barrel raked the Jehu's jaw and made him fall back against the seat, momentarily stunned again. Using both hands, Dietrich pointed the gun at Hobie and pulled back the hammer.
I told you you'd never have her!
Almost even with the stagecoach again, Luke heard Dietrich shout and knew he had to act. The Remington in his right hand came up and blasted a shot. A 36 caliber slug struck Dietrich in the back of the head, bored through his brain, and exploded out between his eyes. Already dead, Dietrich flopped forward, somersaulting over the horses and dropping among them. The hooves did their gruesome work, followed by the wheels of the stagecoach. They chopped Milton Dietrich's body into something that barely resembled a human being. Luke urged his horse alongside the team and leaned over to grab the harness.
Whoa! Whoa! Whoa, damn it! Whoa!
Gradually, the horses slowed, and after another 100 yards or so, the coach lurched to a halt. Before he did anything else, Luke yanked out the Winchester and reloaded as he scanned the trail behind them. He saw several sprawled bodies and riderless horses, but nobody was coming after them. The rest of Dietrich's men appeared to have given up. With the coach no longer moving, Hobie dropped to the ground and jerked the door open.
Jessica! Jess, are you all right?
She practically threw herself out of the coach and into his arms.
Oh, Hobie! Oh, I thought you must be dead!
I was pretty dang close, but I was lucky. And Luke saved my life!
Luke rode over to the coach so he could look in one of the windows. Stephen and Edna Langston were huddled together on the rear seat, but appeared to be unhurt.
Are you folks all right?
We weren't hit. But I don't see how with all that lead flying around.
Hitting the moving target is a lot more difficult than some people make it out to be. Sometimes there's a great deal of luck involved, too. I'd say that luck was on our side today.
Ain't no denying that.
He paid the price for that and all his other sins.
Luke looked back at the ragged, bloody remains of Milton Dietrich.
Sometimes all the money and power in the world doesn't matter a damned bit.
Hobie was still holding Jessica. He saw where Luke was looking.
Do we have to take what's left of him onto my city with us?
What? And cheat the buzzards out of a good meal?
They all agreed. If anyone back in Boston wondered what had become of Milton Dietrich, it was best to let them wonder. After the scavengers were done with what was left of Dietrich, no one would ever be sure who he was or what had happened to him. Dietrich's disappearance somewhere in the West would just be a mystery. When the stagecoach reached Moss City later that day, Jim Pierce reported to the local station master that Banty Sinclair and Sinclair's two sons were dead, apparently murdered by unknown outlaws who had raided the way station and then tried to waylay the stagecoach. That was true enough in its own way. No one knew who had pulled the triggers when the three men were gunned down. Pierce blamed his hoarse voice on an illness, and the station master told him to see the doctor. Another driver and shotgun guard would be taking the coach on the next leg of its journey to California, starting bright and early the next morning. Luke got a hotel room and cleaned up, glad for the chance to do so without anybody shooting at him. He had lost track of Hobie, but assumed the young man was with Jessica or somewhere close by her, wherever she was. The hotel had a decent dining room, and that evening Luke was carving his way through a thick steak when he saw Hobie come in, take off his hat, and glance around the room. Like Luke, the young man had cleaned up and changed clothes. He walked across the room toward Luke. When he reached the table, Luke gestured toward one of the empty chairs.
Hey, Hobie, why don't you join me?
Sorry, Luke, but I can't. I'm supposed to meet Jessica in a little while and have supper with her. She's staying at the Sunset House.
All right, but you look like you have something to tell me. You can sit down long enough to do that, anyway.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Hobie pulled out the chair and sank into it.
Jess and I have been talking about her plans, now that Dietrich's dead.
Jess? From the sound of that, the two of you have gotten pretty friendly in a hurry.
Yeah, being in the middle of a hell of a lot of trouble together will do that, I reckon.
Is she going back to Boston?
No. She's decided she wants to go on to California anyway. Her brother's still the only family she has left.
That makes sense. I think it's a good decision.
And I'm going with her.
Those words rushed out as if he were afraid he couldn't say them if he didn't do it fast. Luke just sat there, still smiling slightly.
Well, aren't you going to try to talk me out of it?
Why would I do that?
Well, you and me are partners. We set out to bring in Gunner Kelly and Dog Eater.
If you remember correctly, we didn't exactly set out to accomplish that goal together. You followed me from Rio Rojo.
Yeah, and it's a darn good thing I did too. Or those rurales would have put you up in front of a firing squad in La Farva.
Possibly. Look, our time together has had its benefits, I won't deny that. But I'm used to working alone, Hobie. I've been doing that for years and years.
You're saying you don't want me partnering up with you anymore?
I'm saying that you're in love with a fine young woman who evidently returns that feeling, and you'd be a damned fool to turn your back on that. Think about it, Hobie. Fate brought you and Jessica Wheeler together, and some force kept both of you alive until you came out on the other side of all the trouble. I don't believe you should fly in the face of what's obviously meant to be.
You really think so?
I really think so.
Well, I reckon you got a point. It does seem like me and Jess were meant to be together.
There you go. Fate.
But you're going on after Kelly and Dog Eater?
They have my $5,000, and I intend to get it back.
Crossing from Arizona into Mexico, Luke noted that if there hadn't been a marker beside the trail, burned into a weathered slab of wood, he wouldn't have been able to tell that he'd passed from one country into the other. The brushy, semi-arid terrain was the same almost as far as the eye could see. Several small ranges of hills broke it up in the distance. Luke was about 100 miles southwest of Moss City, where he had said goodbye to Hobie and Jessica several days earlier. Jessica had hugged him and told him to be sure and stop at her brother's ranch to see them if he ever got to that part of California. Luke had promised that he would, but didn't really expect to keep that promise. He had ridden alone for too long to break the habit. He had used his time in Moss City to find out whatever he could about the mysterious Don Del Oro, mentioning the name in every saloon and cantina in town. For a while, it seemed like he was going to be frustrated in his efforts, but one night he'd bought a beer for an old desert rat with a scruffy beard and a battered hat, and had been rewarded. As he rode farther into Mexico, Luke thought about the conversation.
Sure, the Don Del Oro mine. A gift of gold, they called it. Maybe it was for a while, but the vein played out a long time ago. The place has been abandoned for 20 years or more. I reckon that's why most folks have never heard of it.
Is it here in Arizona?
Nope. Down across the line in old Mexico, in the Sierra Diablitos.
The Little Devils.
Yep, good name for them, too. Them mountains might not be too tall, but they're rugged as all get out. Back in them days, too, they was full of yakis and banditos. Well, it was worth a man's life to be caught out alone. Or so I've heard, you understand. I never laid eyes on the place myself, but I know several fellas have worked there. I think they was just as glad when that vein petered out. They didn't have to risk their lives working there no more.
What about now?
Well, the way I hear it, them yakis has gone farther south into the mountains. The rurales made it pretty hot for them for a while. Most of them Mex lawmen are crookeder than a snake with the rheumatiz. But they're decent engine fighters when they put their minds to it. As for the banditos, though, I couldn't say. That's mighty lonely country down yonder, just made for owl hoots.
So you think that mine is still deserted?
Unless somebody come along and found some more gold in it. And I think I'd have heard about it if it had happened. I keep my ear pretty close to the ground, you know. No telling when you might hear news of a strike.
You said you'd never been to the Don Del Oro.
Yeah, but I know generally where to find it, if that's what you're after, son. Say, you wouldn't be holding out on me, would you? You ain't heard rumors that there's been a strike there.
I give you my word that I haven't. Some men I know mentioned that place. I thought I might look for them there.
If they're at the Don Del Oro, they must not like company. That's about the lonesomest place an hombre could find.
That sounds just like what they would look for.
The old-timer hadn't been able to give Luke exact directions to the abandoned mine, but he'd told him enough to get to the Diablitos. They loomed ahead of him, a rugged line of gray peaks. By the time Luke made camp that night, he didn't seem any closer to them than he had been when he first sighted them. He knew from experience that he had to just keep going until he reached his destination. In the morning, Luke pushed on toward the Little Devils. By midday, the mountains were starting to look somewhat closer. He lost sight of them, however, when he entered an area of ridges and gullies that formed a forbidding badlands. There was no telling how far the break stretched to either side, so he had no choice except to cross them. Luke had been following a serpentine path through the rugged terrain for about an hour when he spotted a little plume of dirt and pebbles sliding down a steep slope ahead of him and to the left. He reined in, jerked his head back to look up the slope, and reached across his body with his right hand for the Remington. The shot echoed crazily from the multitude of rock walls all around him. Dust flew as the bullet chipped a stone to his right.
Don't move! Take your hand away from your gun, senor! I would hate to have to tell my men to shoot you!
Luke wasn't convinced the fellow would hate it all that much. He lifted his hand away from the Remington walnut grips and raised it shoulder high while he held the reins in his other hand. His eyes scanned the slopes. At first, he didn't see anything, but then he picked out several rifle barrels protruding menacingly from behind rocks.
You have the advantage of me, my friends. I'm not looking for trouble, though.
You are an Americano! What are you doing in my country?
Looking for two more Americans.
Stay where you are!
All right.
Luke heard more rocks rattling as somebody shifted around. Suddenly, a gray steeple-crowned sombrero came into view above one of the boulders that littered the slope to his left. Luke recognized it instantly. The sombrero was the sort of headgear worn by the rurales.
This could be bad.
If Luke had run into a rurale patrol, there was every possibility they would try to kill him and steal his horse and all his other belongings. The men who came out from behind the boulder and slid down to the trail wore the gray trousers and short jacket of the rurales. He was young and clean-shaven. Lines etched around his eyes and mouth showed that he wasn't quite as innocent as he first appeared.
I am Lieutenant Diego Sanchez.
Luke Jensen. I'm pleased to make your acquaintance, Lieutenant. At least, I hope I am.
You are alone?
I suspect that you've been watching me for a while and you know I am.
Sanchez shrugged.
At least you did not lie. You are more than a day's ride from the border, Senor Jensen. What brings you to Mexico?
I'm looking for two men.
Friends of yours?
Acquaintances.
Luke had traded shots with Kelly and Dog Eater. That was enough reason to say they were acquainted, he supposed.
What makes you think they are here?
I was told they were bound for the Diablitos.
That was stretching the truth, but it made sense.
Have you seen any other rurales?
The sharply voiced question took Luke by surprise. He was about to say that the only other rurales he had seen had been across the border in New Mexico territory at the settlement called La Farva, but some instinct made him stop. He shook his head.
You and your men are the only ones I've run into since I crossed the border.
You are fortunate. The men we seek are criminals. They deserted their posts and have become renegados. They would have killed you without a second thought and taken everything you own.
Luke thought it probably wouldn't be a good idea to mention that the same idea had crossed his mind about the lieutenant and his men.
So you're looking for some renegades of your own, huh?
Sanchez turned his head and spat eloquently on the ground.
Not my own. They are traitors. They have turned their backs on their duty. Their capitán, a man named Almanzar, is nothing more than scum.
Having had the dubious pleasure of meeting the man, Luke couldn't disagree. While Lieutenant Sanchez, on the other hand, seemed to be that rarest of creatures, an honest rurale. He appeared to be genuinely offended by Almanzar's lawlessness.
I appreciate the warning, Lieutenant. I'll certainly keep my eyes peeled for those men and do my best to avoid them.
You should turn around and return to the United States, Señor Jensen. The Diablitos are not safe for anyone, especially a gringo.
It's important that I find those men. They have something that belongs to me.
I could order you to return to your country. I could take you into custody.
You have a job of your own to do. You don't need to be burdened with a prisoner. And even if I turned around and started north, you wouldn't know whether I kept going or doubled back.
Sanchez's dark eyes narrowed.
I could have you shot.
For no good reason? I don't think you'd do that, Lieutenant.
Luke knew he was gambling his life on the judgment he had made about Sanchez's character.
No, I would not. Consider yourself warned, Señor Jensen. And if you ride on, it will be at your own risk.
It usually is.
If I ever find out that you lie to me about the men I seek, I will find you and make you regret it.
I understand.
Sanchez stood aside and motioned for Luke to go ahead. As Luke nudged his horse into motion and rode past the lieutenant, he was acutely aware that an unknown number of men were still staring at him over the barrels of their rifles. All he could do was hope they would follow their officer's orders and allow him to pass. He followed the trail on through the Badlands, his back braced for the impact of a bullet. He emerged an hour later onto a wide stretch of flats that ran all the way to the base of the mountains. Only then did he have a sense of relief. As he rode toward the Little Devils, he thought about the encounter with the Rurale Patrol. Lieutenant Sanchez and his men were a long way from La Farva over in New Mexico territory, which was the last place Almanzar and the giant Lopez had been seen. He made a cold camp that night and pushed on toward the mountains the next morning. If nothing happened to delay him, he would reach them today, he mused as he rode toward the peaks. Then there would be the matter of locating the Don Del Oro mine, which was supposed to be located at the head of a valley near the northern edge of the mountains, under a sawtooth peak that could be seen for miles. Luke had spotted that sawtooth a couple of days earlier and had been steering toward it ever since. He reached the foothills by midday and pressed on into the mountains. Close up, the peaks were more impressive than they had appeared from a distance. Even though they were considerably shorter than the Rockies, they still loomed massively over a man to make him feel small and insignificant. With the Sawtooth Mountain as his guide, he found a valley that penetrated into the Little Devil's range. According to the old desert rat, who had never been there but had heard about it from others, the mine was located at the head of the valley. If Kelly and Dog Eater were using it as their hideout, Luke couldn't just ride up there. They might see him coming and ambush him. After he had ridden a couple of miles up the valley, he stopped to rest his horse in a jumble of rocks and trees and wait until nightfall before continuing. He even got a little sleep, which showed just how cool-nerved he really was. Once it was dark, he moved up on the valley, taking it slow and easy. His pulse quickened when he spotted a light up ahead. Out in the mountain wilderness, miles from the nearest village, he took the faint glow as a good omen. It had to be man-made, and he told himself that the men who'd made it were the ones he was after. The light grew stronger as he got closer. He dismounted, drew his rifle, and left the horse in a thicket of scrubby pine trees to steal forward on foot. After a few minutes, he was able to make out the buildings of the abandoned mine. Time and the elements had taken a toll. The long adobe building that might have served as a barracks had partially collapsed. So had a smaller squat structure set some distance away that had probably housed the powder magazine. But a house built of stone was still standing not far from the black hole in the side of the mountain that marked the mouth of the mine shaft. The light glowed from a window. The most alarming thing he saw was a sturdy pole corral that appeared to have been built fairly recently. The corral itself wasn't what alarmed him, really, but the dozen horses inside it. Kelly and Dog Eater had stolen horses from the ranch they had raided a day or so out of Rio Rojo, Luke recalled, but probably not that many. From the looks of it, several men besides the two outlaws were inside the house, making his job more complicated. Likely they were the same sort of men as the ones he was after and wouldn't allow him to just waltz in and take Kelly and the Apache. He was pondering his next move when the sound of hoofbeats in the night made him press himself deeper into the shadows under the trees. A lot of horses were coming and moving fast. A group of riders swept past him. With a clatter of hooves, they rode up to the stone house.
Señor Kelly! Señor Creighton!
Two things immediately struck Luke. One was the fact that the man's voice sounded familiar. The other was a question. He wasn't surprised to hear Kelly's name, but who in blazes was Creighton? More lights appeared as several men stepped out of the house. Luke spotted Gunner Kelly and Dog Eater standing in the middle of the group. The rider who had called out stepped down from the saddle and moved into the light from lanterns carried by a couple of men on a porch. The yellow glow reflected off the barrels of guns held by the men on horseback. Luke's jaw tightened as he realized why the man's voice had been familiar. He was Capitan Almanzar, the renegade Rurale officer. Luke looked carefully at the new arrivals and was able to pick out the hulking form of Lopez among the group of night riders.
I have brought you something, senores. I came upon a patrol of my former comrades and thought you might like to question their officer. So we ambushed them. Lopez!
Lopez dismounted and hauled something down from the back of his horse. Carelessly, he tossed the burden on the ground. It was a man's body. He rolled onto his back so that the light shone on his face. Luke recognized the earnest features of the still-living Lieutenant Sanchez.
Several more of the dogs still live. I hope they might provide some entertainment for you, Señor Creighton.
Luke got the biggest surprise of all then. The Apache warrior known as Dog Eater looked down at the captive Lieutenant Sanchez with a fierce, bloodthirsty smile on his face, and then spoke with an accent eerily reminiscent of Milton Dietrich's.
Splendid, Captain. Absolutely splendid. Have Lopez bring the lieutenant inside. The other prisoners can be placed in the old barracks. Part of it still has walls and a roof, and is sturdy enough to contain them.
Luke's mind was reeling. Dog Eater, or rather Creighton, didn't sound like any Apache he'd ever encountered. But there was no doubt in Luke's mind that the man was the same one who had taken that shot at him back in Rio Rojo as the bank robbers made their escape. He never forgot the face of a man who tried to kill him.
What do you want with those rurales?
They might have valuable information regarding how much the Mexican government knows about us. Our plans pose a threat to it, you know.
I don't reckon anybody in Mexico City's ever heard of us. At least not yet.
They will. When we take over all the territory along the border, they'll know who we are. They'll have to deal with us, because we'll be the rulers of this new empire. We won't be a couple of two-bit bank robbers anymore.
The whole thing was loco, Luke thought, but it was starting to make a sort of cockeyed sense. Creighton, or Dog Eater, or whatever the hell his name was, had an ambitious streak. Like everybody else whose trail had crossed that of Gunner Kelly and Dog Eater, Luke had assumed that Kelly was the boss of the pair. Clearly, though, Dog Eater was more than just Kelly's sidekick. From the sound of it, he was the brains of the operation. Luke wondered if he was actually an Apache. Remaining concealed in the shadows, Luke watched as Lopez picked up Sanchez's senseless form, threw it over his shoulder, and carried the officer into the house, following behind Kelly, Creighton, and Almanzar. Luke turned his attention to the other new arrivals and the half-dozen prisoners with them. The captives had their hands tied and were roped together, with the lead rope attached to one of the horses so that they had been forced to run along behind. Luke didn't feel any real sympathy for the captive Rurales. Even Lieutenant Sanchez, who apparently was devoted to his duty, probably wasn't as innocent as he acted. But Luke still wanted to capture or kill the two men he had pursued, and since the odds against him had gone up, he needed some allies. He didn't have to like those Rurales to get some use out of them. The men who had ridden in with Almanzar and Lopez prodded the prisoners toward the old barracks. One of the men who had brought a lantern out of the house went with them. By its light, Luke got a look at the gang Kelly and Creighton had gathered. The outlaws were the usual motley mix of border trash from both sides of the line, some Mexican, some gringo, all hardened killers and thieves. They were plenty dangerous, all right, but not impressive in any other way. Luke waited until the prisoners had been marched into the barracks and the outlaws returned outside. A couple didn't emerge from the building, and Luke supposed they had been left to guard the Rurales. The others unsaddled their horses and turned them into the corral. Then the men went into the stone house. The old Don Del Oro mine was quiet again. Luke's brain worked quickly. He couldn't get to Kelly and Creighton as long as they were surrounded by nearly a dozen men. What he needed was a distraction to draw the others out of the house. The prisoners would provide that distraction if he could set them free. They would know they would be fighting for their lives. Luke set out to circle around toward the old barracks. He used every bit of cover and shadow he could find and moved with the stealth that had become part of him during his years of manhunting. Luke reached the far side of the partially collapsed adobe building and knelt a couple of feet from a large gap where part of the wall had fallen in. He took off his hat and edged his head into the gap to take a look. It was too dark to see anything, but he sensed the guards were close by. Luke knew he couldn't just bust in there with guns blazing. That would alert the men in the house and ruin any chance he had at taking them by surprise. After thinking for a moment, he picked up a chunk of adobe that had been left scattered on the ground when the wall collapsed. He tossed it so that it landed with a thud about a dozen feet on the other side of the gap. The noise was loud enough to be heard inside the barracks.
Did you hear that?
It must have been Almanzar, or one of the other men.
They all went into the house. There is no reason for any of them to be behind the barracks.
It was nothing. Just one of those noises that the night makes.
Luke tossed a smaller, fist-sized piece of adobe. It bounced when it hit the ground and clattered against the wall.
Something is back there.
An animal. I'll take a look.
Luke heard wary footsteps as the man approached the opening in the wall. A rifle barrel protruded through the opening first, then the guard leaned forward to peer along the wall in the direction of the sounds. He stood motionless for a long moment. Not seeing anything, he stepped over the 8 inches of adobe wall that still stood at the bottom of the opening, turning his back to Luke. The bounty hunter was ready. He had drawn the right-hand Remington and reversed it, gripping it so he could strike with the butt. It smashed into the back of the guard's head with a crunch of bone. The man dropped like a shot.
Paco!
The other guard hadn't been able to tell exactly what had happened in the shadows behind the barracks, but he had heard the impact of Luke's gun against the first man's head.
Paco, are you all right?
Paco was long past being able to answer. Several tense moments went by. Luke waited, utterly quiet. Finally, he heard the soft shuffle of reluctant footsteps approaching the opening. The other guard wasn't a fool. Without warning, his sombrero sailed out through the gap in the wall. Luke's steely nerves kept him from reacting, but he knew that a lot of men who were keyed up for trouble would have been spooked into taking a shot at the headgear. When the sombrero didn't draw a response, the guard stuck his head out to take a look. Luke didn't wait for the men to step completely out of the barracks. He struck instantly. The Remington flashed down, and once again the gun butt smashed into bone with enough force to shatter it. The guard was conscious just long enough to let out a grunt of surprise and pain before he slumped forward. Luke grabbed his collar and hauled him over to what was left of the wall, letting him spill on the ground behind the barracks. He checked for a pulse on both men, but didn't find one on either. Straightening, Luke stepped over the wall and into the old barracks. He turned his gun around and held it ready to fire. Enough starlight came through the big holes in the roof for him to make out a door on the other side of the room. The bar that rested in brackets across it told him the prisoners had to be on the other side. He moved quickly and put his mouth to the tiny crack beside the door.
Anybody in there speak English?
I speak some, gringo. Who are you?
The man Lieutenant Sanchez spoke to yesterday in the Badlands. I've come to get you out of there.
Are you not part of the same gang as the traitor Salmazar and Lopez?
I'm not. I came here to bring the leaders of that gang to justice. The men called Kelly and Creighton.
Then you are, bounty hunter?
That's right. I'm only interested in those two. You can have Almanzar, Lopez, and the rest.
How? We have no weapons.
There are two dead guards out here. They each had a rifle, a pistol, and a machete. That's enough to arm six of you. If you can lure the other members of the gang in here and jump them, you ought to be able to take their weapons away and use them.
Some of us will be killed.
That may be true, but they massacred your compadres. This is your chance for vengeance.
Luke hoped that would appeal to the rurales.
If you let us out, what would you have us do in return?
Wait here for 10 minutes. Then, take one of the guns and fire several quick shots as if you were breaking out and the guards are trying to stop you. That ought to be enough to bring the others out here to see what's going on.
What about Lieutenant Sanchez?
I'll find him and see that he's safe. I just need you men to make sure the odds aren't overwhelming against me.
Those men ambushed us, shot on our amigos without mercy. And they told us why they were dragging us here, that they would make us scream and beg for death. We think they are the ones who should scream.
That sounds good to me. Do we have a deal?
We have a deal, gringo. If we can trust you to keep your word.
We have to trust each other. You'll find the dead guards right outside the back wall. Remember, give me 10 minutes before you make your move.
Si, 10 minutes.
Luke holstered his gun and took hold of the bar that kept the door closed. It was long, thick, and heavy, designed for two men to lower into place. With a grunt of effort, Luke strained against the bar, felt it move, and then clear the brackets. As soon as he felt it come free, he stepped back quickly and let go of it. The bar crashed to the hard-packed dirt floor. The door swung open, but only a couple of inches before the bar stopped it again.
Put your backs into it and you can shove the door open now. I have to go.
He ducked quickly through the opening in the wall. He circled back to the trees where he'd left his horse and untied the animal. Leading the horse, he hurried toward the back of the stone house. He was counting off the seconds in his head as he moved. He knew he couldn't count on anything more than an approximation of the time the rurales were supposed to wait before they fired those shots. By the time he reached 300, he was crouched next to an old shed behind the superintendent's residence. The house didn't have a back door, but there were a couple of windows on that side. Leaving the horse ground-hitched by the shed, Luke stole closer to the house. He pressed against the wall beneath one of the windows and listened. The room was dark and quiet. After another minute had gone by, he reached up, gripped the sill, and hauled himself in. Light came along a corridor from another room. He drew both revolvers and crept toward it, pausing outside the door. The crackle of flames from around the corner told him there was a fireplace in the room. Luke looked around. He was too much in plain sight. When the rurales staged their distraction and the outlaws rushed out, he might be spotted. He eased into a doorless alcove where the shadows were thick enough to keep him from being seen. He stood in Stygian darkness and continued counting the seconds. He was closing in on 600. After the shots, he heard responses from inside the house. Then all hell broke loose. With a battle going on outside, Luke saw his chance. He grasped both guns, stepped out of the alcove, and swung around the corner into the room where the light came from. Instantly, he spotted three men and leveled the Remingtons at them.
Don't move!
Actually, there were four men in the room, Luke realized a second later. Creighton, Kelly, Almanzar, and Lieutenant Sanchez. He hadn't seen the young rurale officer because he was lying on the floor where it appeared Almanzar had been kicking him. The little renegade Almanzar stared at Luke in amazement for a heartbeat.
You!
You know this bastard, Almanzar?
Kelly stood tensely in front of the fireplace as if he wanted to slap leather. But he and Creighton and Almanzar were all grouped together so that Luke could cover them at the same time.
He seems familiar to me as well, but I can't quite Rio Rojo! The man in the hotel window, correct?
That's right. My name's Luke Jensen.
And you've been on our trail ever since then? Remarkable.
Almanzar pointed a trembling finger at Luke.
He ruined everything for me in La Farva. We should kill him!
Feel free to reach for your gun, Captain. I'm sure Mr. Jensen would be glad to kill you. And that would give Gunner and me the time to kill him.
You'd be betting that I can't get all three of you.
It's a good bet.
Like Almanzar, Kelly was shaking a little from anger and the desire to kill. Creighton leaned his head toward the door.
I assume you're responsible for that disturbance?
I figured it might be a good idea to have some sort of distraction going on while I got in here and found the lieutenant.
So you killed the guards in the barracks and freed the prisoners. A sound strategy. It would also have been wise to start shooting as soon as you stepped in here. Why didn't you?
A couple of reasons. I didn't know exactly where Lieutenant Sanchez was, and I didn't want him catching a stray slug. And the other reason, mister, is you.
Creighton's swarthy face was as stolid as ever, but a flash of amusement twinkled in his dark eyes.
You're mystified by me, eh?
I heard you talk outside. I figured I had to find out how an Apache, Mescalero, right, wound up with a Boston accent.
I prefer to think of it as a Harvard accent, since I spent a year there. And as for your guess, yes, I am part of the Mescalero band, but only half. My father was Alexander Creighton. Have you heard of him?
I can't say as I have.
He was a railroad man, a tycoon, some people called him. He had a mansion in Phoenix. My mother worked there as a maid. She was captured in a cavalry raid when she was just a girl and lived for years among the whites. Despite having a wife of his own, my father fancied her. When I came along, he named me Sebastian and tried to see to it that I was educated and raised as white, even though he never officially claimed me as his own. He even sent me back east to college. Unfortunately, the other side of my heritage was stronger than he or even I realized. It came out one day during a disagreement with a fellow student. When he attacked me, I reacted instinctively.
You killed him?
Actually, no. I did scalp him, but he survived. The university tends to frown on behavior like that, however, so I was expelled. I had no choice but to return west. My father disowned me, and I went to live among my mother's people. But they didn't want me either.
So you turned outlaw.
I'll be much more than a simple outlaw before I'm through. I'll be the lord and master of this whole part of the country.
You called yourself Dog Eater and teamed up with Kelly so everybody would think he was the one running things. You didn't figure anybody would pay attention to a half-breed.
The shooting had stopped outside. Luke could only hope that the battle had ended with the Rurales having the upper hand. If the outlaws had won, the odds of him surviving the next 5 minutes were pretty slim.
You're obviously an intelligent man, Mr. Jensen. It's a shame you're not going to get out of here alive.
What makes you think that?
Creighton nodded toward the doorway behind Luke.
Because you're about to be ripped limb from limb.
Luke might have thought Creighton was trying to trick him, but at that moment he heard a heavy footstep behind him. He twisted around in time to see Lopez lunging at him. Luke saw Creighton, Kelly, and Almanzar grab for their guns and fired both Remingtons. Flame spurted from the barrels. Lopez was too big a target to miss, but the bullets seemed to have no effect on him. He crashed into Luke and drove him back against the table. The wood was rotten and splintered under the impact. They went down amid the debris. The giant Rurale fell on top of Luke, forcing all the air out of his lungs. Luke managed to hang onto the gun in his right hand, but lost his grip on the left-hand revolver and it slipped away from him. Lopez's weight pinned him to the floor. Luke gasped for air he couldn't get. Lopez had one huge hand wrapped around his throat and the other hand around the wrist of his gun hand. Luke couldn't breathe, nor could he bring the Remington to bear. Blood roared like a raging river inside Luke's head, and a crimson haze dropped over his eyes. He knew he was only seconds away from dying. Even if he could somehow survive Lopez's onslaught, Creighton, Kelly, and Almanzar had drawn their guns and were waiting to fill him with lead as soon as they got the chance. Through the red haze, Luke saw something that the others couldn't. Behind them, Lieutenant Sanchez was forcing his bloody, battered form up from the floor. That glance gave Luke a glimmer of hope. He flailed out with his free hand and closed his fingers around a jagged piece of the broken table. He put all the strength he could muster behind the blow. Lopez spasmed wildly. Luke felt drops like hot rain spray across his face. It was blood, and it came from the hideous wound the sharp piece of wood had torn in the giant's throat. Lopez's grip suddenly weakened. Lopez's big hands pawed feebly at the piece of wood stuck in his ravaged throat as Luke shoved him aside and rolled away from him. But when Luke came up on one knee, he saw flame geyser from the muzzle of the revolver in Almanzar's hand as the captain struggled with Sanchez over the weapon. Almanzar was occupied for the moment, leaving Creighton and Kelly to try to kill Luke. Both fired as Luke threw himself flat on the floor. He triggered the Remington he still held and put two bullets into Gunner Kelly's chest. The red-headed outlaw rocked back as his eyes widened in pain and shock. Almanzar and Sanchez reeled into Creighton, upsetting the aim of the half-breed Apache. Luke fired. Creighton jerked around as the bullet clipped him on the right arm. His gun fell from suddenly nerveless fingers. Creighton's face twisted in hate and insane rage as he pulled a machete with his left hand from behind the sash around his waist and leaped at Luke. Luke rolled aside desperately. The machete hit the plank floor and stuck. As Creighton struggled to rip the machete out of the floor, he swung a backhand at Luke as the bounty hunter dove to the floor to avoid it. The machete came free, and Creighton raised it to deal a death blow to Luke. From the floor, Luke fired his last two rounds. The slugs punched into Creighton's gut and doubled him over. He dropped the machete, clutched at his belly, and stumbled forward. He lay there on his face as a pool of blood spread around him. Across the room, Almanzar broke free of Sanchez and struck him across the face, causing him to fall down. With his back to Luke, Almanzar raised the pistol he still held and aimed it at the fallen Sanchez. Luke saw that, but the gun in his hand was empty. His other Remington was well out of reach. He snatched up Creighton's machete and whipped it forward in a last-ditch throw. The machete struck Almanzar with such force that the blade drove all the way through his body and stuck its bloody tip a few inches out from his chest. Almanzar's back arched, his head tipped forward, and he looked down at what he could see of the machete. Then the gun slipped from his fingers. His eyes rolled up in their sockets, and he pitched forward onto the floor. Luke scrambled to his feet. A quick step took him to the reloaded Remington. He scooped it up and turned to cover the outlaws if any of them still wanted to fight. All four of them were dead.
Sanchez, how bad are you hurt?
I will be all right, senor. What about you?
I think I'm all right. If you can stand up, you better grab a gun so we can check on what happened outside.
See, my men not a...
They jumped the rest of this bunch. I don't reckon you and I would be alive if they hadn't.
Sanchez armed himself with a couple of pistols from the dead men, and Luke picked up one of the guns as well, not taking the time to reload his empty Remington. They stepped out of the house to look across a scene of carnage. Bodies lay sprawled under the light from the risen moon. Rurales and renegades alike, none of them was moving. No one moaned or made a sound. It was a field of death. The two groups had wiped each other out.
Go get a lantern. We'll see if we can find any survivors.
The search turned out to be futile. Everyone at the abandoned mine was dead except for Luke and Sanchez. The young officer muttered horrified prayers as he realized the rest of his patrol had been killed.
What am I going to do now?
He seemed to direct the question to the universe at large as much as to Luke.
Go back to your superior officers and report that you and your men valiantly did battle with a gang of outlaws and killed them. Your men all died as heroes. Maybe they'll get medals, posthumously.
Sanchez shook his head.
Not in the Rurales. There will be no medals for them, or for me.
At least you get your life. That's the best reward.
I will be disgraced when I go back. I lost all my men.
You might be surprised. Your superior officers won't care about that as much as they will that you succeeded in wiping out those deserters, along with a bunch of other outlaws.
But you and your friends killed many of the deserters at that town called La Farva.
Well, nobody in Mexico knows that except you and me, now do they?
Luke went back into the house and walked over to Almanzar's body. Reaching down, he grasped the handle of the machete and pulled it free. Sanchez came into the room after him.
What are you going to do, Senor Jensen?
Luke wiped off the blade on Almanzar's clothes, then tested the keenness of the blade with his thumb and eyed the necks of Creighton and Kelly.
I came down here below the border looking for a couple things. I intend to take them back with me.
2 weeks later, Luke rode into Rio Rojo. He no longer had the heads of Sebastian Creighton, alias Dog Eater, and Gunner Kelly with him, and he was thankful for that. They had smelled bad enough by the time he'd gotten to Tucson and had the sheriff there identify them. The lawman had sent the necessary wires, and Luke's reward was waiting for him. He did have the money stolen from the bank in Rio Rojo with him in his saddlebags, but no one knew that except him. He had found it cached in the stone house at the abandoned mine and was able to pack it away without Lieutenant Sanchez being aware of it. Since then, Luke hadn't told anyone about the money because he hadn't wanted to have to guard it from would-be thieves all the way back to Rio Rojo. He had taken his leave of Sanchez at the Don Del Oro after shaking the young officer's hand and thanking him for helping to save his life. As Luke rode past the livery stable, Cyril Dunbar came out of the barn.
Luke Jensen! Didn't know if we'd ever see you again in these parts.
How are you, Mr. Dunbar?
Oh, I'm fine. Middling fair, I reckon, considering I don't have any help anymore. That boy Hobie done ran off.
Luke grinned.
Oh, I know. He decided he wanted to be a bounty hunter. Then he changed his mind, took up with a beautiful redhead, and headed off to California. To go into the ranching business, I expect.
Dunbar stared at him for a couple of seconds as he tied his horse to a hitch rail.
How in blazes do you know all that?
It's a long story. How's your brother doing? Is he up and around yet?
Getting there. He goes into his office an hour or so a day. I think he's there now, in fact.
I'm glad to hear he's recuperating. Maybe it'll make him feel even better to know that the two men who shot him and robbed the bank are both dead.
The liveryman nodded.
Caught up to him, did you? Have much trouble along the way?
Not that much. Well, so long, Cyril.
All right.
Luke lifted a hand in farewell and walked to the marshal's office. When he went in, Marshal Cyrus Dunbar looked up from the desk where he was drinking coffee and sorting through some papers.
Jensen! Good Lord, man. You've been gone so long, nobody figured you were coming back.
Yeah, that's sort of what your brother told me.
Luke set his saddlebags on the desk in front of the marshal.
There's the bank's money. I didn't bring the heads of Kelly and Dog Eater with me, but they're dead too.
I know. Got a wire from the sheriff in Tucson. It didn't say anything about the money, though.
Figured I'd play those cards pretty close to my vest.
The lawman nodded in understanding.
That was probably smart of you. Of course, you could have just kept riding with that money and nobody would have ever known the difference.
That's not the way I do business, Marshal. I want what's coming to me from Monroe Epps and Kelly and Dog Eater and recovering the money. That's all.
You'll have it. I'll see to that. And so will Mrs. Vanderslice. She'll be mighty pleased to see you.
I've been on the trail for a long time. I ought to get some of this dust off of me first. You'll take care of those saddlebags for me?
Dunbar stood up, moving carefully.
I'll take them over to the bank right now and see that they're locked up in the safe. Good work, Jensen. You've got a good payday coming to you.
I'll take it, Marshal. I'll sure take it.
Luke Jensen, Bounty Hunter, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2013, William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with the Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Unauthorized download or duplication is prohibited. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Bradley Smith, Christopher Sheeran, Elizabeth Jernigan, James Konacek, David Coyne, Scott McCormick, Michael John Casey, Thomas Keegan, Ken Jackson, Danny Gavigan, Joe Brack, Tim Pabone, Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, Dylan Lynch, Ren Casey, James Lewis, Christopher Graybill, Barbara Pinolini, Jeff Allen, Lily Beacon, Nathaniel Perry, Nanette Savard, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Thomas Hogan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Eric Messner. The Bounty Hunter theme was composed by Thomas Hogan. Additional original music composed and performed by Thomas Hogan and Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Luke Jensen, Bounty Hunter, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com and be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man and Sidewinders series and Elmer Kelton's Texas Rangers series, all available from Graphic Audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads, audio guides, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
Rusty, you and me, we're going to shut down the saloon starting at midnight the 1st.
It ain't gonna be we, Sheriff. It's gonna be you alone. I'm resigning at 11:59 the evening of December 31st, and that's not negotiable unless the dry law's repealed. I aim to live, and I'm just bullet fodder if I keep the badge.
Now, you listen close and get that jail ready, because the Women's Temperance Union is gonna fill it to overflowing!
Uh-huh. My ma used to tell me that women get notions.
If lily-livered men won't do it, women will. We're organized and ready. When midnight New Year's Eve rolls around, we'll attack.
You can't do it with brooms, ma'am. You'll get shot.
Not even the most corrupt and craven and debased male in Doubtful will shoot women.
I wouldn't be too sure of it. My deputy, Rusty, he told me he'd as soon shoot a woman as a man.
Well then, I admire Rusty. He sees us as equals. Now, the good souls in the Women's Temperance Union have divided into three woman militias. Three militia women for each saloon. Here's how it'll play out. At midnight, we'll enter, two of us with shotguns, one woman with a revolver to cover the rear and pick off snipers. We'll give the saloon man 2 or 3 minutes to shut down or not. If not, our bird shot'll clean out the glass on the back bar and not a soul will fight back. They're all as lily-livered as the town's businessmen.
If I had a good posse, I'd get her done fast. I don't. You have to be patient. Beginning at midnight, January 1, I'll be the only man with a badge in the whole blamed county.
Goose Cannon here, out of Cheyenne. You the sheriff?
I am. Cotton Pickens.
Good. We're here to help out. I didn't know if we'd make it in time, but we did. We got hired by the Women's Temperance Union to help you shut down all them saloons at 1 minute after midnight.
Hired?
Yeah, they wired us for help. We're willing to work for anyone, long as we're well paid. We got us some of the best artillerists this side of Possum Creek. The lady said you'd deputize us, just to keep it all on the up and up. We'll just bust in right after midnight and shoot out the lights.
Cannon, that's not what we got cooking here. But thanks for the help.
It don't matter whether you pin badges on us. At 1 minute after midnight, we're gonna shut down Doubtful like it's never been shut down before.
Rusty, this here is Scuffy Scruggs and Ezra Panhandle. They're powder men from the mines. They've got a mess of powder tied outside.
What do you mean, powder?
6 crates of DuPont Hercules dynamite and all the fixings.
Jesus, I'm out of here.
Couldn't be safer. It's just nitro and clay formed into sticks. That's what dynamite is. You'd have trouble blowing up a housefly with it.
They won't tell me why they're here.
They won't say? Oh, it's not your business long as we don't violate the law.
I think it's our business. Why are you on Saloon Row with that stuff?
We're just a couple of wayfarers lost in the cold.
You're a smartass. What were you there for?
To take a leak. There's an outhouse behind every saloon.
Where were you headed? What's the powder for?
You sure are a nosy one, Sheriff.
All right. I'm escorting you out of town. We're gonna move that powder far from here. Then you're free to return. Turk's Livery can care for the mules if you want.
We're free men. We'll go where we want.
Don't resist, Sheriff. There's a ticket to hell waiting for you if you do.
Head to the alley. Watch the fireworks. See the biggest show in town.
You're resisting arrest.
You stay out of it, and you might live. We're just helping you enforce the law, Sheriff. Call us a posse. Call us friends. Call us the strong arm of the law.
I'll call you men in big trouble.
Now, get out of the saloons. They're all ready to blow.
Is it midnight yet?
Exactly midnight. Happy New Year. The fuse gets lit at the count of three. One, two, three.
Blood Valley 5, Wyoming Slaughter.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220, or go to www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, or want the complete series now, check out our long-haul MP3 series sets, conveniently shipped to you on a USB flash drive. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.